Occult crimes, paranormal investigations, urban legends, and strange happenings. Welcome to Myths, Magic, and Murder.
Life. It's life and death.
Wow.
I even sang it like a Victorian.
You sang it? Oh, are you, for every episode of Life and Death, are you going to sing it in how they would have sang it?
Yeah, dude. Can't wait for Egyptian.
Yeah.
That'll
be totally normal
and
definitely not offensive in
dude,
any way.
No one's going to get offended. What, I'm going to offend ancient Egyptians? Best of luck.
If anyone knows how ancient Egyptians sounded, it's Kate.
Yeah, the most ancient and most Egyptian person you could ever find.
I've
never once stepped foot in Egypt.
If you're watching this, Kate is the whitest person you've ever seen.
I have to make sure that the camera is focusing on me properly, otherwise I turn into a ghost midway through. Anyway, I'm Kate.
I'm Abby, and welcome to Myths, Magic and Murder, Life and Death.
Oh my god, I don't like that you announced it.
Well, we didn't really discuss a format, so I assumed that I would go, since this is a different kind of episode. Do you want to do it?
No, it's fine.
You can say it.
Nope.
You can say it.
No, the moment's gone.
Life and Death.
Oh, that was scary. Anyway.
What if we're scary now?
What if we're a spooky podcast?
What if we come back and we actually are scary? It's funny because this episode really isn't scary, but it is going to be really interesting and really gross.
It's funny as well because I'm wearing a knit cardigan.
Yeah, horror. So this is a new format that we're trying out on the podcast, which we call Life and Death.
I caught on that time.
Yeah.
You were looking at me, not blinking, going, come on.
Pick it up, Kate.
Do it.
So the format for this podcast is we're going to talk about an era of gruesome times. In today's episode, we're discussing the Victorian era.
The Victorian era.
Which is where Kate picked up Kate from when I went in the time machine.
Hello, Governor.
You're talking about the gruesome facts of life within the Victorian era and everything that encompasses that. Food. Other things. I don't know what you're covering.
Ooh.
And I am talking about all of the awful, horrible, gross, nasty things to do with death and burial and medicine.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. It's going to be interesting. We're going to have a little bit of a back and forth, kind of a bit of a more casual episode. So we'll see if you guys like this.
Yeah.
Let us know what you think.
If you don't dry heave, I've not done my job.
We're still going to be doing normal episodes next week. We have a normal episode written out and ready to record for you guys. So do not panic. But this is something a bit different that we're going to try out. Let us know how you feel about it. Should I go first?
Yeah,
do you have anything else to say? Should we speed on what we've been up to recently? We've been playing Baldur's Gate 3. We've been playing Baldur's Gate 3, and we've been playing Baldur's Gate 3. Okay, anyway, so I'm going to be talking about some of the craziest and most questionable things about the Victorian era in life. My sources are Tasting Table, Wikipedia, Pearlage Suite, BBC, Medium, Smithsonian, English Heritage, Townsend on YouTube, and Weird History. So a little overview on the Victorian era. It was obviously Queen Victoria's reign over the UK between 1837 and 1901. First, let's talk about some absolutely wild food choices that were made in the Victorian era.
Okay, I'm thinking.
In Victorian England.
When I made that sandwich that time and it had pastrami and peanut butter on it. That was my wild Victorian choice.
You think that
I think that's what you're going to talk about.
We didn't close the window.
Woo!
Yes.
Circle back.
Yes, I'm going to get to the part where they ate all the mummies. Do not worry. But first...
Are they what?
One of the biggest issues with food in Victorian England was how terrible the quality of everything was. Almost everything the average person bought had been modified in some way.
Yuck. We hate GM foods.
Organic only.
Yeah.
During the Victorian era, adding harmful or cheaper substances to food products was popular because it could deceive consumers and increase produce. So merchants and producers would substitute or dilute ingredients with alternatives in order to increase the weight without increasing the cost of making the thing.
Like how they still do now.
They do, but it's at least like body safe.
Yes. I was thinking bacon, right?
Mm-hmm.
They like put water in it and that's why you can get the same amount of bacon cheaper from like a cheaper brand.
Yeah. Well, this one was a little bit more gross. So some common substitutes added into flour were chalk, plaster of Paris, and sawdust. These would be put into the flour and sold, or baked into bread to increase the weight of the bread. This was obviously extremely harmful in the long run, because you were eating sawdust just like every day. Every day you ate bread, you'd just be eating, like, chalk. You shouldn't be putting that in your body.
You shouldn't, bud.
Y'all shouldn't be putting that in there.
Who the hell was that?
And it didn't end with bread. Spices often had brick dust or ground up rocks or even lead sprinkled into them to enhance the colour and increase the quantity.
I always say, man, I wish this had a sprinkling of
When I'm making my chili, I think,
Oh,
consider this brick dust.
Oh, yeah.
It also wasn't uncommon when baking to use food colouring containing arsenic, copper, and lead to enhance the appearance of food.
Of course. Chuck it in.
Milk was commonly bought during the Victorian era, the same way it is today, but refrigeration wasn't discovered quite yet, so they got kind of creative trying to figure out how they were going to preserve it.
Mm-hmm.
It was common to boil milk in an attempt to let it, you know, be better, and then store it. Thank you. I was trying to think of the word.
Be better!
Be better, milk! In an attempt to, like, preserve it and keep it in a cooler place. But sometimes people would add preservatives in, such as borax and formaldehyde, to try and keep it fresh.
I've always said, man, I wish my milk smelled like a dead body.
So borax was added because they thought it kept it purified. Okay. The Victorians thought that adding it was a harmless addition, and household members would add it in themselves. So rather than the manufacturers doing it like with flour, the people would buy the milk, and then they would put borax in it because they thought that it would help the milk last longer.
It's giving 5-minute craft.
And hello, welcome today on this 5-minute craft.
Right? It's, yeah, for sure.
Did you know?
Milk going off, and then it's someone, like, crying at their milk.
They spill the milk everywhere?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then they scoop it all back in.
Put borax in that?
Yeah.
It did smell better, and it did taste better. However, what was actually happening is that Borax masks! Even stronger! Borax masks the sour taste and smell of rotten milk.
Mm-hmm.
So they were actually consuming rancid milk with borax in it, not knowing that it was borax and also entirely spoiled.
Mm.
So it did taste better, or it did smell better, like in terms of, like, obviously it tasted, I imagine, like borax, but it didn't smell and taste like it was rancid, but it was, obviously, because that's not how you preserve milk.
Wait, do people know what borax is?
Do you want to mention that?
Yeah, it's like a salt that we use for, like, household cleaning and, like, detergents and stuff. So I can see how they thought it was edible because it's a salt.
Mm-hmm.
But don't eat that. That's bad for you.
Now, the bit where we all want to gag.
Oh!
The Victorians ate mummies, as in mummified human remains. So gross. Can't think about it. So gross. My God. How is the human race still alive? Just doing things. Just doing things. Just out here, just doing shit.
Do you know, it's certainly not because of England.
Yeah.
I think if anything, we hindered.
So the Victorians ate mummies. Obviously, not all of them. But, like, this was something reserved for the wealthy or those with connections to Egypt, travel or traders. I'm going to say not all of them because there's this, people keep talking online about, like, the Victorians ate all of the mummies. They didn't eat all of them. They did consume mummies, but we still have those. They're not like...
I've seen a mummy.
Those things exist. Yeah.
And I ate it.
No! How was it?
Delicious.
During the Victorian era, there was a trend of consuming mummified remains, particularly through powder form. They consumed this powder called mummy powder or mummia, as they thought it had medicinal properties, as well as mystical qualities. They thought it would cure a wide range of diseases. The mummies were sourced from Egypt at the time, when the Victorians were fascinated with the concept of Egypt, and wealthy people from Britain would obviously bring back souvenirs from Egypt when they came back, which included mummified remains. Mummy powder was often ingested through eating it, mixed with honey, or in pills. It was sometimes added to water or wine. However, it was also added sometimes in oils or other ointments to be used as topical medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, now we know that consuming mummies is obviously not recommended because it can cause serious health problems. It's cannibalism, and also it caused a serious issue for Egypt because we were just eating all their cultural heritage. Absolutely wild.
Yeah, I think it's one thing for the UK to have stolen everyone else's art and statues and history, because just why the fuck not? But it's another thing entirely to eat it.
Yeah, to be like, oh, you guys preserved these dead people? Crazy, we're going to eat it now.
Yeah, like, at least...
What are you doing?
At least we can give the art back. I mean, whether they fucking will is another situation. But, like, there's the option. You can't give back something after you ate it. Well, you can, but no one wants it.
No, yuck.
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 Yeah. I don't know at what point I would be convinced to eat a mummy. Like, how much would you have to be paid?
To eat, like, to do the mummy pill? Or, like, am I, like,
you see knife the mummy, and fork and... No, you see the mummy beforehand, then they powder it, and you have to, like, eat the powder pill.
You know what it is. $1 billion.
A billion?
Yeah.
Why are you in dollars? You're British, do you know?
Is it not worth more?
No, the pound is stronger than
the $1 billion. Yeah, because I've seen a mummy too. And you know what I thought? Ah! Ah!
It was scary.
Ah, that's a dead guy. Oh my god, that's a dead guy. It's an old dead guy. Ah! I'm not eating that. You know what that makes me not want to do? Eat a meal. Take a pill. Consume.
It's reminiscent of the way that formaldehyde makes people crave food.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, maybe they cracked open a sarcophagus and they were like, oh, could go for a burger. Don't have one. That's next best.
Uh-huh. I can understand why they were, why they thought it was mystical. But, I mean, it's still massively fucked, right?
I mean, that's one way to put it, Ab. Really sugarcoated, though.
Yeah.
Speaking of death, this feels like my territory.
It is, yeah, this is for you. Take the floor.
So my sources are Wikipedia, the Horrible Histories TV program.
Oh, yeah. I was like, hey, Kate, I'm reading now. And you were like, and I could hear in the background, like, Gorgeous Georgians.
Yeah, well.
Best show. Love it.
It's a really good show. They had a lot on Victorians, but not a lot on the gruesome side, which I was surprised at.
Maybe it's not too, because it's for children.
Mm. There were some really messed up things in there. There was a skit called Stupid Deaths.
Yeah, but, like, it was lighthearted. It wasn't like, here's some gross thing.
It was pretty gross. Anyway, National Geographic, BBC, historicmysteries.com, nationalarchives.gov.uk, edinburgh-history.co.uk, mentalfloss.com, grunge.com, fablecollective.com.
Nice.
So, I'm going to start off by talking about the Victorian Necropolis Railway. Picture this. It's the Victorian era.
Woo!
Bustling with innovation, eccentricity, exciting things.
Eating mummies.
Eating mummies. And London has a big issue. Graveyard overcrowding.
Mm.
Yeah, because of cholera, which I haven't gone into in this, but maybe we'll do a part two on
Victorians. Yeah, I do have more stuff I'd like to cover for a part two.
The city's population was booming and a lot of people were dying. So traditional burial grounds in the city were reaching their limits and hygiene concerns were growing because we had a bunch of dead bodies left. Mm. So the London Necropolis Company was formed in 1852 to tackle this grave dilemma.
Oh. Woohoo.
That's the reaction I wanted from my joke, was not a laugh. You two instead go, woohoo. This was a dedicated railway line to transport the deceased and their mourners to a new burial site away from the city centre. The Necropolis Railway operated from its own station near Waterloo in London. The station had two separate platforms, one for mourners and one for coffins. The coffins were in a specially designed hearse carriage, while the mourners travelled in first, second or third class carriages, depending on their budget. Living passengers were charged 6 shillings for a first-class seat, 3 shillings 6 pence for a second-class seat, and 2 shillings for a third-class seat, which in today's money is £31, £19, and £10 respectively for a round-trip ticket.
$1 million.
The trains would travel to Brookwood Cemetery in Surrey, which is about 23 miles southwest of Waterloo. Brookwood Cemetery was the largest cemetery in the world at the time. It was designed specifically to accommodate the overflow of London's dead and was often referred to as the London Necropolis. The railway operated for over 87 years, providing its unique service until 1941, where it was disrupted by World War II. because it got bombed.
Ooh.
After the war, there were changes in funeral practices and transportation anyway, so no one used it, and it was eventually discontinued in 1941. Also, safety coffins.
Mm.
Yeah. Known as security coffins or life-preserving coffins, they were developed in the 18th and 19th century. There was a massive, widespread fear of premature burial during this era, which is called taphophobia. The fear was there mainly because of limited medical knowledge, and so there were occasional instances of people being mistakenly pronounced dead. These safety coffins were equipped with various mechanisms intended to prevent premature burial or to facilitate escape if the event occurred.
So crazy.
Horrific, right?
The fact that it was, I mean, obviously not common, but common enough that you'd have to be like, hey, maybe we should, like, build everything special.
Mm-hmm.
Gross.
Some safety coffins had mechanisms such as bells attached to strings that extended into the grave. This is the one that I know about.
Mm-hmm.
The strings were tied to the hands or wrists of the deceased, so if they woke up, they could just, like, wriggle around a bit and ring the bells, alerting those above ground.
Mm-hmm.
Which is what coined the name Dead Ringer, right?
I don't know, but that would sound logical, yeah.
Yeah. Other safety mechanisms featured latches or levers inside the coffin that could be operated from within to open the lid. What use that is with tons of dirt above you, I'm not sure.
Mm.
Additionally, some designs incorporated viewing windows or even feeding tubes to provide the supposedly deceased person with light or sustenance. One notable example is the Bateson Revival device, patented in 1868 by British inventor George Bateson. This device had a bell attached to a spring-loaded mechanism, which would ring if the person inside moved. While these safety measures might sound practical, in reality they were often more psychological reassurance than effective safeguards. Mm. The chances of someone waking up were very rare, and many of the devices were prone to malfunction or false alarms, making the night shift as a graveyard worker a very daunting task. Plus, most of the safety coffins forgot to include an air source. So even if they did wake up, they wouldn't have been awake for long.
Horrific. Mm-hmm. So while it's not, like, very common, I mean, obviously I just said it wasn't common, it was more so, like, you wouldn't be scared that it would happen to you because you know that you have all the procedures in place.
Exactly, yeah. Right. It's like insurance almost. Right. Or for the family as well. Like, if you're like, man, is he really dead? Like, I don't know. There was a magician, wasn't there, around the same time where he had, like, a note in his pocket that was like, hey, don't bury me. If I get into a deep hypnosis, it can look like I'm dead.
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I'll if we do a part two on it, I'll probably cover that.
Okay.
But yeah, it's sort of reassurance for you and your loved ones that, like, you're not going to be buried alive.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of burials, etc., some people never even got buried, as Scottish law said that scientists could perform their medical research on the cadavers of those that had died in prison, suicide victims, abandoned children, and orphans. Pretty slim pickings, which was extremely frustrating to scientists as they were under pressure to figure out how the human body even worked.
Mm-hmm.
This created the perfect environment for grave robbers.
Woohoo!
Or resurrectionists, as they're also known. Ah. Why are you giving me, like, theatre replies? It's behind you.
Just, you know, I don't know, something about Victorian gives me pantomime vibes.
Fair enough, I get it. However, a lot of the bodies were old and people started to implement safety procedures. For example, the rich would use heavy table tombstones, vaults, and mausoleums to protect their dead. The poor would put pebbles and flowers on graves to see if there'd been any disturbance when they visited again.
Mm-hmm.
They dug heather and branches into the soil to make it more difficult to, like, exhume a body.
That's so crazy, isn't it? They have to put in this many procedures.
Mm-hmm. Well, the mort safe was invented around 1816, which were iron or iron and stone devices that weighed a lot in many different designs. Quite often, though, they were complex, heavy iron contraptions of rods and plates padlocked together. They looked like a giant cage over the tops of the graves. They were placed over coffins for about 6 weeks, then removed for further use when the body inside had sufficiently decayed. Like, it was pointless, no one was going to dig it up.
Because
I used to think they were digging up the bodies to, like, take their, like, rings or whatever. That was, like, what grave robbing meant to me when I was younger.
I mean, that was still a thing though, right?
Yeah, it still happened, but around this time it was less common.
Yeah, okay.
Because if you had those riches, a lot of the time you'd give them to your family.
Fair.
Or if you had enough of them, you would have a better grave.
Get a mausoleum.
Yeah. So when a lodger in William Hare's house died, he turned to his friend William Burke for advice, because said lodger owed him £4 in back rent. Obviously that's £4 then, not £4 now.
Mm-hmm.
So they decided to sell the body to a local scientist, Robert Knox. They received what was for them the generous sum of £7.10, which in today's money is about £545.
Fair.
Then a few months later, in January or February of 1828, one of Hare's lodgers was sick and delirious with fever, so the pair got him drunk and suffocated him.
Oh.
They were worried he would put off prospective tenants. Then they took the body to Robert Knox, who gave them £10 this time. The victims in total numbered at least 16, though the true count is unknown. The duo's gruesome business thrived for about a year, but their operation came crashing down when they attempted to murder Margaret Doherty, a woman whose appearance raised suspicions. Her body was discovered, so the murder was successful, but they'd found, like, bloody rags. So although they didn't actually find the body, they found rags, and they'd sort of added everything together, been like, hey, loads of people have gone missing that know you or lodged in your house or whatever. So they were arrested in 1828. Hare turned against Burke in exchange for immunity. So Burke was tried, found guilty of murder, and sentenced to death. But his punishment didn't end with his execution, because his body was dissected as part of the same anatomical studies that he had supplied his victims to.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. And that is death.
Damn.
Right? That's on death.
Damn. Well, I have more to say. So let's talk a little bit more about living, but more gross living.
Boo.
So as we're going to find out from Kay in just a moment, and I'm going to feel violently ill, the Victorians had some wild and questionable medicine. However, some good things did come of the era for medicine and surgery. The introduction of antiseptic techniques was discovered at this time. So prior to development of antiseptic surgery, people practiced what historians call dirty surgery, which in itself is an awful phrase. I know, I'm really sorry, Kate. She doesn't like surgery.
No.
Close your ears, little guy. Sorry. It's very early. Before we realise, hey, maybe bodies are vulnerable and, like, mushy, we used surgical instruments without proper sterilisation. It wasn't purposefully gross for the most part. They were giving it their best shot. They were giving it a go. But surgeons would use alcohol, or they would boil the tools, or they would give the equipment a wipe down. But that obviously, as we know now, isn't enough to kill the bacteria when you're operating on somebody.
Mm-hmm.
There was also a lack of hand washing and gloves, and many operating rooms weren't as clean as they should have been, or sometimes they would even do the operation in a patient's home, which obviously isn't sterile. You can't do that. Unfortunately for them, and fortunately for us, the mass amounts of developments and experimentation in history, especially in Victorian times, means that things were learned very quickly, which allowed things like medicine to grow quite rapidly. A man called Joseph Lister, who was a British surgeon, was like, hang on, check this out, antiseptics, carbolic acid to be precise. He figured out that if we put that on things like skin, tools, and dressings, and even spraying it, like, in the air during surgery to kill the bacteria, the infection rate of patients rapidly dropped. He also promoted the use of washing hands and advocated for the use of sterile dressings. People were skeptical at first because they were like, this is a waste of time, this will not work, you know, this is too much resource or whatever. And there was some pushback from other surgeons, but then eventually they realized that that kind of was working. It was the only thing that was working, so this was the only way forward. Good forms of Victorian medicine also included the development of diagnostic tools, such as the stethoscope. Stethoscope. Thank you. And microscope.
That one was easy.
Yeah, well, I can say that one easy. Before this, physicians would simply just rely on observational skills and patient history to know whether something was wrong. And also a major development was the creation of anaesthetics. Before anaesthetics, surgery was still performed. Obviously, this was excruciating for patients and difficult for surgeons to perform the operations because they were people wriggling. Were awake the whole time.
Quit your wriggling.
Stop that. Surgeons had to perform quickly because they didn't want to hurt the person, but this meant that it was kind of like not very precise. Or
just lock often, the whole leg off.
Yeah, often if it was a traumatic surgery, they would have like an assistant hold the person down, like restrain them. Mm-hmm. But yeah, absolutely awful, very scary. But sometimes they could give them alcohol or opium to try and make them feel less aware of their surroundings and relax a bit, which I guess is kind of smart. Like, it's kind of the only thing you can do.
For sure.
But that didn't really alleviate the pain, and also it rapidly increased the risk of addiction.
Mm. Also, doesn't alcohol thin your blood?
Yeah, overall not good. Like, you know, you don't want to give someone alcohol and then have to hold them down and do surgery quickly. The whole thing is a nightmare. It's awful.
Yeah. I personally just don't really fancy don't do holding it. Someone down and performing surgery in my own house.
Yeah. You know, I would say I recommend not doing it, but
I'm going to say if you want to, don't.
Yeah, just say no.
Just say no.
Yeah. However, while this is all extremely awful and terrifying, anesthetics were discovered in the Victorian era.
Yay!
There were a couple of ways that they did this. The first was nitrous oxide, which we still use now for dental procedures, and we discovered we could do that in the 19th century. It wasn't as common because the results weren't always very affected, but we did realise it could work. Obviously now, we understand it better. Other forms of anesthetics were chloroform and ether. Ether was quite commonly used because it was cheap and effective, but chloroform was sometimes preferred because it was faster and more powerful. We didn't know the side effects of using chloroform at this point, but obviously now we know this can cause medical issues, especially as the dosage wasn't very precise and administration was not the way it is nowadays. You know,
yeah, just chuck it on some cloth and
they would kind of just give it a good go with all of this stuff. Nothing was measured. They had no idea what was going to happen. They were just like, well, this makes you go to sleep, so good night. And that was it. So
go to sleep.
I hope you wake up and everything's fine.
Cutting in the head repeatedly.
What do you have to say about medicine?
Well, I actually have one thing to say about dirty surgery.
Oh, yeah.
And that's when you were saying it was unclean, I read a thing while I was looking at the dentistry, which I'm about to cover, and that is that the surgeons wouldn't wash their aprons, so they would be covered in dried blood and mm-hmm. pus and whatever, and they would wear it out to be like, look, I'm a surgeon. And then they would wear it for their next, like, operation.
Oh, God.
Yeah. So, dentistry. At the beginning of the Victorian era, dentist experience was even more stressful than you can imagine. Like you said, there was nothing to dull the pain, none of the instruments were sterilized, and the instruments were a lot more clunky than they are today.
Oh, I hate dentistry.
Yes. There was a lot more, sort of, it was more hack and slash in the mouth area.
Hash slinging. Mash slinging slasher.
Yeah, they were mash slinging, hash flinging slasher. After a few years, anesthetics made painless dentistry possible. At the same time, sugar consumption in the British diet increased.
Delicious.
Greatly increasing instances of tooth decay. As a result, more and more people were having teeth extracted and needing dentures. This gave rise to Waterloo teeth. These were dentures made with real human teeth set into hand-carved pieces of ivory from hippopotamus or walrus jaws. The teeth were obtained from executed criminals, victims of battlefields, grave robbers, and even bought from the desperately impoverished.
Oh, you can wait. Okay, hold
on. You can wait.
They had other people's teeth in their mouth. Ah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's one of the grossest things I've ever heard.
Yeah.
I would rather learn more about dirty surgery.
I wouldn't. So I'm carrying on.
Having someone else's teeth in your face that you've bought from them?
Mm-hmm.
Someone can be like, here's my tooth, and you can be like, sick, and put it in your head?
Mm-hmm. Well, have you ever seen Les Mis?
Yeah, but I don't remember it very well.
She, like, sells her teeth. Definitely in the film. I haven't seen the stage play, which is obviously what it is originally, but Anne Hathaway, fantastic performance from her. When she shaves her head and stuff, I'm pretty sure she gets a tooth ripped out.
I don't remember. Wow, that's really horrid. What about the hippopotamus? Sorry, I couldn't focus on that because I was so...
So they would get ivory from hippopotami, or walruses, and they would like carve it into the plate of the denture.
Right.
And then they would set real human teeth on top of that plate.
I mean, it is smart.
Yeah, it definitely makes sense because like fashion was such a thing in the Victorian era, right? Mm. Like you didn't want to walk around and have one tooth.
Yeah, for sure.
But it's gross.
It is gross.
Yeah.
And it's not as like logically gross as some of the other stuff we talked about, but like for me personally, mm-hmm. it makes me feel yuck.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Yuggy.
Yeah, I read that and I was like, ewy. I'll be telling out.
Yuck.
They also performed bloodletting, not as part of dentistry, but as part of medicine as a whole. It was a prominent medical practice rooted in ancient theories of bodily functions. Practitioners believed that health depended on maintaining a balance of bodily fluids. When this balance was disrupted, illnesses occurred. It was thought to restore the equilibrium by reducing the quantity of blood in the body so that it matched the other levels of the liquids in the body.
Mm-hmm.
Methods of bloodletting varied. The most common approach was venesection, which involved making small incisions in veins, typically in the arm, to allow blood to flow out. Other methods included arteriotomy, which is cutting an artery, and leeching, where medicinal leeches were applied to the skin to draw blood. Once attached, they would pierce the skin with their tiny teeth and secrete substances into the wound, including hirudin, an anticoagulant that prevented blood from clotting. This allowed the leech to feed on blood continuously until it was satiated, after which it would detach and drop off the patient. Victorian practitioners believed that leeches possessed unique healing properties. They thought that the saliva of leeches contained medicinal substances that would purify the blood, remove toxins, and alleviate various ailments. Leeching was used to treat conditions such as fevers, inflammations, headaches, bruises, varicose veins, and even mental disorders. Other instruments were used for bloodletting too. They ranged from simple lancets to more complex devices like scarificators, which made multiple incisions quickly and evenly. Suffice it to say, having a leech stuck on the side of your head probably won't cure depression.
No.
Like, I'm going to say for you people at home,
don't
do that.
Try that one.
Just give it a miss.
You know, now I'm thinking about it, maybe just don't try any of these.
Boring.
Kate's taking my teeth out on camera.
Stay still.
I can see how they thought that would work.
Yes.
That makes sense.
Well, this is it's what I think gross. With a lot of Victorian yeah. stuff.
You can tell that they were experimenting.
Yeah, they were so close a lot of the time.
Mm.
Also, they had tonics and elixirs as part of medicine as a whole. They were popular remedies in the Victorian era.
Are you going to sing the song?
Song.
Miracle elixir.
This is piss.
This piss with ink. The other day, Kate and I were hanging out, and it was like maybe half 11 p.m. And she was like, "Oh, do you mind if I just put a song on this? Something in my head." So I thought she was gonna play like, you know, like a song, like relaxing and for bed or like a party, like something normal.
I went on Spotify and I started playing my song that had been in my head for hours. And as Dawn Pirelli's Miracle Elixir came on, Abby just looked at me like I just took a shit.
When you said something stuck in my head, I didn't think it was going to be that random song from the Sweeney Todd soundtrack.
It was great. It's a great song.
Fair, yeah.
Fight me on it.
I'm not fighting anyone.
No, I'm not going to sing the song, even though I just did.
You already did. Just finish it now.
Okay. They were marketed as cure-alls for a wide range of ailments. The concoctions typically contained a combination of ingredients, including herbs, alcohol, and sometimes potent substances like narcotics or stimulants. They were heavily promoted through advertising, making crazy claims that they could, like, fix anything that was wrong with you. They were marketed as solutions to cure things from, like, common colds to, like, tuberculosis and cancer. Manufacturers relied on persuasive advertising techniques, testimonials, and endorsements from physicians to promote their products. The tonics and elixirs were pretty much unregulated, right? And their safety and efficacy were often questionable. Like, even from the testimonies, you didn't know if people had been paid to give that testimony.
Yeah, for sure. We have those now. It's just people do it on Shopify instead of in the streets.
Yeah, it's just TikTok people, right? Many products contain potent or addictive substances, as I said, which made concerns for addiction, overdose, and other adverse effects basically like come to the forefront, which is what essentially stopped tonics and elixirs. But let me give you a couple of examples of elixirs. First, we've got Vin Mariani, which was a tonic wine infused with coca leaves. It was an elixir created by Angelo Mariani, a French chemist, in the late 19th century.
Sounds good.
When it went on the market, it gained widespread popularity for its purported invigorating effects. Probably because of the fact that the coca leaves aren't cocoa leaves, they're coca leaves, which is what cocaine is made from.
Oh. Well, sounds super effective.
Oh, dude, this one did what it said on the tin.
Yeah.
It was marketed as a tonic for physical and mental fatigue.
He could have been selling that for way more.
And it was endorsed by numerous celebrities, apparently even including the Pope.
Wow.
Despite its success, it faced criticisms for the fact that it had cocaine in it, so it was banned.
I wonder at what point, I don't really know a lot about drug regulation, we were like, hey, we shouldn't be doing that.
Well, it depends on what country as well, because I was supposed to go to Nepal just before they had an earthquake. Or Bolivia. I can't remember which one it was. It was one of the two. The trip got changed from Bolivia to Nepal, and then they had an earthquake, so we didn't go. But we were told that, like, they just sell it on the street. They just sell the leaves, because it isn't as much as doing cocaine.
Yeah.
It's not like doing a line, but you will feel more energized. It's like, I guess, like an energy drink.
Yeah, like, why is that banned? Do you know what I mean? Like, at what point were we like... We shouldn't do that, because if you're like, yeah, chewing on a leaf, like a natural thing, probably, and then you feel good about it, like at what point were we like, we shouldn't allow that anymore?
Probably because, I mean, I hate to say it because this is such a made up thing, but it was probably a gateway drug.
Mm.
You know what everyone says about marijuana, even though marijuana is not a gateway drug.
I refuse to believe it. Yeah, like for the most part, yeah, I agree.
So they probably did that because like people were probably like, hey, I don't feel as buzzed from this leaf anymore. Let's just do cocaine.
Mm.
And the government can't tax it.
True.
So
this is true.
That's probably it.
Mm.
Also, strychnine was an elixir given to people, which is rat poison.
Mm. Yeah, shouldn't be doing that.
No. It was primarily used for its stimulant and tonic properties. It was believed to have invigorating effects on the nervous system and was sometimes prescribed as a treatment for conditions such as depression, lethargy.
Lethargy. That's what lethargy. I always say. But maybe I'm wrong.
I don't know.
I don't think I've ever said that out loud.
No, me neither. It's the same as like...
I can't believe everyone's correct
tussled
us.
Hair. Is it tousled? Tussled?
No, tussled.
It's definitely tussled, right? When I used to read it as a kid all the time, I was like, tousled. And then someone said tussled. I was like, oh my god,
there's nothing worse and more embarrassing than when you read something as a kid and you think you know the word and then you say it out loud and someone corrects you. And you know what's even more embarrassing is when you've never said the word out loud until you're a grown-up adult, but you read it as a child and now you think you know how to say the word, but I'm 26 and I've done that many times, I think. I think I did it recently.
Dude, I did it literally the other day.
And you were like, what are you doing? And I was like, what?
Yeah. I did it the other day scalding. I've been saying as scalding, as in telling someone off, and scalding.
Oh.
Like, ow, that's hot. And you know who corrected me? Daniel.
Wow.
And I felt like such a mug, because he did it in front of everyone. And I was like, I'm going to get you.
I did it the other day when we were playing a game. I can't remember what it was. I said something and you said, oh, is it pronounced like that? I thought it was pronounced like that. You weren't trying to correct me. You were just like, we were obviously both just like, wait.
Wait a second.
But I said it and I was like, I don't think I should have said that. Because I have it in my head as well where sometimes I'm like, don't say that out loud because you know it's wrong. Mm-hmm. But I'll still read it like that because I've been reading it like that forever.
Yeah, that's
so
me
then
with
I have
tussled.
To force myself to say it differently out loud.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hate that. And I hate it with characters' names and then they make a film.
And
you're like, oh my God. Mm-hmm. What do you mean that's not how you say the name?
I am lucky in that I did a lot of reading as a kid, and so a lot of the time...
Me too, but I still didn't get any better,
hang
I guess.
On! I said a lot of the time, I would ask my mum.
Right.
Because my mum just knows. My mum is like... My mum is omniscient. She knows. And so I would say to my mum, hey mum, how do you say this? And she'd be like, miscellaneous. And I was like, thanks.
One thing about my mum is that she don't know. Look,
hope you're listening, Bernie.
She doesn't know how to do that. Look, she is nice. She's real nice.
She's so nice.
She don't know.
No, she don't know.
She don't know.
She don't know.
She don't know anything, dude.
No.
So If I said to her, "Hey, mom, how do you spell?"
How you smell?
How do you say miscellaneous? Like, how do I read this from the book? She'd probably say, "I don't know."
Yeah.
Ask someone else.
Yeah.
Which, like, no, that's why
I
mean, like,
I was lucky.
Yeah.
That my mom knows. Maybe your mom knows, and she's just like, "Haha, you're dumb."
I would say lethargy
and paralysis.
Yes.
In small doses, strychnine was thought to enhance.
You mean paralysis?
Shut up. Strychnine was thought to enhance mental alertness and physical performance.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases, it was used recreationally as a stimulant or performance enhancer, particularly in the form of tonics or elixirs containing small amounts. These products were marketed as health boosters, energy supplements, and would appeal to individuals to be, like, one step ahead. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, boss got you down at work, take strychnine.
Okay.
You'll be promoted.
Damn, okay, maybe I will.
Like, that kind of advert, okay. You know? I don't know why I made it American in Victorian times, but they still existed, I'm aware.
Yeah, you know, America, I mean, was discovered 3 years ago.
America's new, right? Like, America's like baby?
Like, real new.
Even though they used strychnine medically and recreationally, they knew that it would kill rats. Like, they used it as a pest killer at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And there were criminal strychnine poisonings. So, like, they knew.
They knew.
But they just didn't care.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Also, Mrs. Winslow's soothing syrup was a widely marketed remedy for babies that were screaming because they were teething during the Victorian era. It contained a mixture of only baby-friendly things, morphine, alcohol, sugar.
All the things that babies love.
Yeah. If babies could talk, they would tell you, "Mother, I need morphine, alcohol, sugar."
Baby coming out the womb.
Baby fresh out the womb.
Morphine. Sounds kind of good though, you know?
Shut up. It was marketed as an effective pain reliever and sedative for infants experiencing teething discomfort.
I mean, it sounds like it would be effective.
Well, that's the thing, it
recommended,
worked.
Though, I don't know.
It worked, and so it was popular amongst parents that just needed a break.
Yeah.
Right? And also, they thought it was helping their kid.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you
because
would trust
like,
that.
Okay, great. They've stopped screaming. They're obviously not in pain anymore, which they weren't because they were high as a kite.
Yeah.
It faced criticism from medical professionals because it was addictive and it was definitely harmful. Like, there's no two ways about it. So it was taken off the shelves. Bovanine was a tonic elixir made from the blood of cattle. It was developed by Dr. John Myers in the late 19th century and had supposed health benefits and therapeutic properties.
Was John Myers a vampire?
It rhymes.
Everyone knows that's what it's true. That's what the cow said. Look, first off, I'm vegetarian. That was a mean joke. Second off,
that was so...
everyone knows that what you do is what you rhyme with.
Subscribe to our Patreon to watch me absolutely lose it at that joke.
For example, I'm Abby. I'm Crabby. Oh. What else rhymes?
The only bad things rhyme with your name.
Flabby. Like,
yeah. Scabby.
You know what? I'm yucky.
What rhymes with Catherine?
You've never went by that name on the podcast before, and so I'm completely unprepared as to what to say.
I know. I knew you were going to go with Kate because it's the easy one.
Yeah, great.
Mate.
Sedate.
Oh yeah, I love to sedate
Hate.
People. Anyway,
Mathrin.
Bovanine had supposed health benefits. It was marketed as a general tonic for improving strength, vitality, and overall well-being, and was recommended for individuals recovering from illness or surgery, as well as those experiencing fatigue, weakness, or nutritional deficiencies. So basically, everyone.
Mm.
Right? Like, every single person. And that's the thing with all of these, is that they cater to everyone.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, have you just had a surgery, or do you maybe have a little bruise?
I do.
Because you could both use it.
Oh. Sounds normal.
Some advocates also claimed that bovanine had immune-boosting and rejuvenating effects. Despite its claims, bovanine faced criticism for the fact that people fucking hated drinking cow's blood.
Yeah, well...
Like, it was stinky, it was yucky, it tasted nasty, hate. And there was no proof that it did any of what it said on the bottle.
Yeah, I don't think people should be doing that.
No.
That feels like something that you shouldn't be ingesting.
No, people naturally cannot ingest that much blood.
Yeah.
So, yuck. Yucky, ew. Don't do that. But you know what? I understand the side of it that's like, oh yeah, it'll help you, like, nutritionally, because there's, like, a lot of iron in blood, right?
Yeah.
And, like, I understand, again, I understand the logic. I mean, I'm sure a lot of these people were just doing it for money, right?
Yeah.
But, like, I get the logic. I get how you could market that, because you could be like, okay, everything that that cow had that you don't have, you can ingest, and then you will have.
Yeah. There's a thought.
Yeah. The final one isn't scary. I just thought it was fun. I didn't know it. It's Parrish Chemical Food. This was a tonic syrup developed by pharmacist Caleb Davis Bradham in the late 19th century. Contained a mixture of herbs, roots, and flavourings, along with phosphoric acid, which is just like a stabiliser, right? It was marketed as a health tonic and digestive aid. Parrish's Chemical Food gained popularity as a refreshing beverage and was later rebranded as Pepsi Cola.
Oh!
Yeah.
I love Pepsi Cola.
I know! So all of the above tonics, like all of the ones that I've just mentioned, could just be bought over the counter.
Mm.
Yeah, you didn't need a prescription. Or if a travelling salesman happened to be on the street...
Even better, you didn't even have to go
there.
You
don't even have to go in a shop.
Man.
You just buy them.
I would love if we had travelling salesmen now. But for normal things that we buy. Like the ice cream man, but for more things. I want a bus to drive by and be like, would you like... a juice?
You would be the easiest person to kidnap in the whole entire world. I want an unmarked white van to come and pick me up
and I want bring them to say, pizza. Excuse me, would you like some fries?
Sweeties, little girl?
Yeah.
No.
Oh, I failed.
Yes, and weirdly, I was watching Fallout, the new TV show, which is great. I really enjoyed it. And there was a traveling... snake oil guy, right? Mm-hmm. And they're all known as snake oil people, like snake oil salesmen, because like that was the thing, right?
Yeah,
like, they would just sell you anything, mm-hmm. like in a bottle, most of the time probably piss, right? Like, just give you that, it'll cure your head wound, you'll mm-hmm. be fine, and then you would die. So like, they wouldn't have anyone writing on Yelp that yeah. they were bad.
Couldn't do that now.
No, dude, every time I buy snake oil, I'm on Yelp.
Yeah. She's drank a lot of snake oil and piss.
I've drank so much. So glad to be back on the podcast. Where I can tell you only very true facts about myself.
Yeah, super regular things that are definitely true.
Anyway.
Kate's never ingested piss or oil.
No.
Not even
olive.
Well,
I've eaten oil.
You've what?
Yeah, I've had olive.
You eat it straight out of the bottle.
I've had no snakes. No snakes for me. Vegan girly.
Yeah. Don't oil a snake.
Yuck! Oh, you can, though. Oil a snake.
Oh, like put oil on the snake?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I thought you meant... I was imagining getting the snake.
Squeeze it. Yeah.
Getting the oil.
Hmm.
Is that your last bit?
Yeah, I'm done.
You're completely done.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, so the last part of today is a little bit of information about the home, so that you don't have any gross, horrible elixir dreams.
Ooh, gimme. The elixir dreams.
There are more things I'd like to cover, so if you do want a part two, do let us know. Now, living at home for the common folk back in the Victorian era was obviously not as easy as it is today. Many Victorian cities experienced overcrowding due to rapid population growth because of industrialization.
And they didn't even have a TV.
Oh, they didn't even have PlayStation 5.
Yuck.
They couldn't even play Fortnite.
Ugh, how are you going to play Baldur's Gate?
I would die. Large families often lived in cramped rooms, with multiple people sleeping on the floor being quite common. This obviously wasn't ideal, because not only was it uncomfortable, but it also meant that the disease spread far quicker. Disease.
Yes, I hear you.
I didn't say it right.
Disease.
Indoor plumbing, one of my favourite aspects of being alive nowadays, was also not very popular, mm-hmm. especially with the commoners. Residents relied on communal outdoor spaces with poor sanitation, leading to streets being full of garbage and human waste. However, Some wealthy people did have plumbing that allowed them to have baths and toilets.
Bruv, the streets being full of garbage and human waste is giving, like, Sunday morning Liverpool.
What?
You know, like, after everyone's been out for the night.
Yeah, we venture out for a cup of coffee and it's like...
fucking Church Street or something and it's like, oh.
Yeah. He's very, unfortunately, trim. It was a significant development for hygiene, having indoor plumbing, but it also came with problems because everything came with problems. Early versions of indoor plumbing ran the risk of dangerous gas buildup. Toilets were often connected to sewage systems that lacked proper ventilation. Because of this, flammable gas, like methane, produced by human waste...
Farts.
...was all packed into the sewers together.
Fart sewer.
This... shut up. This would accumulate... and go back into the home through indoor plumbing connections, meaning that sometimes people's toilets just exploded if you brought in a gas lamp or a candle. This wasn't necessarily common, but exploding toilets did happen. Another hazard regarding the bathroom was that most of the time hot water was supplied by boiling water before a bath. And, you know, you can see where that was leading.
Hot bath.
Hot bath.
Were they like iron tubs?
Scalding.
Scalding.
Mm-hmm.
Not scalding, turns out.
It turns out. Staircases in Victorian homes were also very dangerous, especially large homes intended for the use of servants. As the population was growing, houses were constructed far quicker than they should have been, without much consideration for safety standards, so servant staircases were often added as like a secondary feature to allow them to pass through without being noticed. They weren't nearly as looked after as the main staircases of the home, of course. They were narrow and steep and put away in small spaces and corners. The steps were often irregular, and they increased the risk of tripping and falling. And you have to imagine as well that the servants are wearing, like, long skirts, they're carrying things.
What if I don't want to imagine it?
You have to. This overall proved to be a pretty deadly combination, and fatal accidents were tragically not uncommon for servants via staircases. Things were also often flammable in the homes, and because they were so overcrowded and so close together, this could cause problems for fire safety. Not only this, but a common weather-resistant coat for surfaces was lead-based paint.
Mm.
This was used widely because it was affordable and versatile, and it was used on walls, windows, doors, and exterior surfaces. If you're unfamiliar with the concept of lead-based paint, it was banned in most countries in the 1970s, because it's extremely dangerous. It can lead to cognitive impairment, anemia, kidney damage, reproductive problems, and cause an increased risk of cardiovascular disease, heart disease, coma, seizures, and death in high levels.
Bruv, lead was in everything, wasn't it?
They were just putting lead in everything.
It's like the glassware that you have. Yeah. You have like an old decanter, and my dad was like, hey, that's lead.
Yeah, I was just drinking out of that.
Yeah.
That's why I can't look properly anymore.
Yeah, that's why you have impaired cognitive function.
That's why I can't speak. Yeah,
It's why you don't know how to say...
for stethoscope. No, they were putting it in things. They just were. And it's like what we were saying this whole time. They were giving everything a go, not realizing. I mean, we've been doing that forever. Mm-hmm. We were talking about this the other day. Like, at what point are we going to look back on this era and be like, oh God, why were we doing that? That's crazy. Like, asbestos was so common. They were like, this is great. This is cheap. And now we're like, oh my God, this could kill you.
Yeah, well, it's still in everything, right? Yeah. Like, so many buildings have got asbestos.
It's just if you tamper with it, right, then it becomes a problem.
There are three, I think... different types of asbestos, and like they're like different colors, they're named different colors. And the one that is most common for like the buildings, it's like mixed in with the concrete, so unless you're like taking your house down or whatever, it's not necessarily going to come out of that. But like asbestos ceilings, with like Artex ceilings,
mm-hmm.
that was a lot more dangerous, like, yeah. If whatever, like, as the house moves. Because houses move a lot in Britain, and I feel like they don't move in any other country. I've never heard anyone be like, my house is just moving. Like, it's just settling. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, yeah, they do just settle.
You don't hear that anywhere else. Like, houses are fucking loud here because they're just constantly, like, having a little jiggle. So anyway.
But surely they would, because houses in America are made out of, like, wood, right?
Dude, houses in America, I watched a video the other day and someone took apart the wall just with, like, a Stanley knife.
Oh my God.
Because it was like so thin. I don't know. I don't have the ability to talk about houses in America. But
yeah, we ain't there.
No. But I don't know, because I feel like a lot of it's due to changes in weather, and a lot of different countries have a lot more consistent weather than we do.
Mm-hmm.
Like here it was sunny and 17 degrees, and then the next day it was hail.
Yeah, it's bad here. Weather-wise, it is not good.
No.
I mean, people joke about how bad the weather is in England. It is bad. It's bad, and not only is it bad, but it changes fast.
Yeah, you never know what's coming.
No.
Like, apparently there's a storm now, and it's been a storm for like a week.
Yeah, I think it's over now.
God alone knows.
Who even knows anymore? It's hard to keep up with.
Yeah. I don't remember what I was saying, but it was important.
Asbestos.
Mm-hmm.
Houses settle.
Yeah.
That's what we were saying. Yeah, because I was saying there are so many things that we've tried as people and been like, yeah, that's really smart. Like, they were putting lead in everything. They were like, it's so cheap. It's so durable. It's so versatile. Yes, it is. It's also deadly. We didn't know that.
Well, it's the same as like in the 90s, everything was made of plastic. And like the early 2000s, everything is made of plastic. And now we have microplastics in the ocean. Like
now, now there's microplastics in your blood.
Yeah, now that's just in us. Like, okay, what's going to happen now? Like, I'm interested. I mean, I'm scared because I'm scared. I have anxiety. But, like, I'm interested to see what things will be like, hey, you shouldn't be looking at a screen 22 out of 24 hours because this has happened, you know, because, like, you know, maybe we all turn 60 and then our brains are mush. Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
And I'm interested.
I am interested. Ah. Yeah.
Let us know what you think is going to be this generation's lead poisoning.
Yeah, I would love to know, actually. That's a really fascinating topic.
Yeah.
If you want to follow the podcast on social media, you can do that at MidsMagicPod on Facebook and Instagram. And we have a Patreon where we have video content, and we also have little extra stuff that we put on there as well. We're going to do a full-length extended Patreon exclusive episode. Yeah, in just a week, I think. Very soon. So that'll be on there, and we're going to try and be a bit more consistent with that as well. So if you'd like to go support us on there, you can do that. The pledges have changed. You can still give as much or a little as you want. It's still the same, but now you have to pick a tier, but it's just the way Patreon is, it works. Like, it's, you can still donate as much as you want. You just have to pick it now. You can't type it in. And it is stupid, and I hate it, but that's just how it is now. Mm-hmm. But yeah, if you've already joined, you should be completely fine. It shouldn't impact you at all. But yes, that is the episode today.
Yeah, Patreon has video content of us. And before every episode, we do a little
chat. We do a little 10-minute or so, just debrief, chat, casual kind of hangout. And it's fun. It's
we
fun.
Talked about SpongeBob, I think, today.
Well, it's SpongeBob is good.
Anyway, before SpongeBob gets into this episode, don't listen before bed.
Listen before bed. And tell us what you think.
Yeah.